Well, I am grateful for a wonderful introduction. How many of you, as I was standing next to Pastor Scott, were thinking, that is the biggest Jewish person I've ever seen in my life? I do get that a lot, I have to tell you. Over the course of the weekend, we're going to try to answer some questions for you. But at the same time, there'll be time for you to ask some questions too. So as I speak, if there are things that you want to ask, there'll be a Q&A time. I mean, if you want to do it privately, we'll try to answer every question that you have over the course of the weekend. And, you know, I like to try to share a little bit about what I'm like. So the way I try to do that, especially over a weekend, is share these little stories. So over the course of the weekend, you're going to hear some stories like what I'm going to share with you now. And this is a story about a guy who was robbing a house. House was completely pitch black. And as he was putting the loot in his sack, he thought he heard a voice. And it was sort of like a whisper. And the voice said, "Jesus is going to get you." And he stopped. And he's thinking, nah. And he's continuing to do. The room is pitch black. And sure enough, he hears once again, but in a different part of the room, "Jesus is going to get you." So now he's starting to get frightened. And he's thinking it was his misfortune of picking a haunted house to rob. And he remembered that he had a cigarette lighter in his pocket. So he took the cigarette lighter out and he flicked the lighter out on. And he looked, and there sitting on a bookshelf, in the corner of the room was this big old parrot. And the parrot looked at him and said, "Jesus is going to get you." And he kind of smiled. He says, "Wow, Polly, I thought you were a ghost." And the parrot looked at him and said, "My name's not Polly, it's Moses." He said, "Moses? What kind of person names their parrot Moses?" He said, "The same person that named their Rottweiler Jesus. Get him, Jesus!" And that actually has nothing to do with what I'm going to share with you tonight, but I just like to tell that story just so you can see what I'm about. You can put on the PowerPoint. We're going to try to, over the course of the weekend, answer some questions. And the first question is a question that people really are interested in knowing. How did we get to where we are, especially about Israel? And I go to Israel all the time. I just got back first week in November. And it's a very interesting place. Pastor Scott, I know, had a great time while he was in Israel. One of the things that we do is go all over the country, and especially to the places where Jesus was. And it's an amazing, amazing trip. But the question, how did we get to where we are, is so crucial in understanding what we as Christians ought to be thinking about and praying about when it comes to Israel. So we're going to try to answer that question. How do we get to where we are? Tomorrow morning, we're going to look at a question of evangelism. What are we going to do about it? The fact that we are in a world that is in turmoil, what are we going to do about it? How do we take advantage of the fact that this is a place that is in turmoil? I mean, right now, even as we speak, there are demonstrations going on in New York City. And tonight, for the first time, there's going to be counter-demonstrations. So hopefully there won't be some violence. But this is an unprecedented time. I can tell you from the people that I know that Israel is very happy the way the election turned out. Very happy. And the people that President-elect Trump is surrounding himself with are very pro-Israel. So I think Israel is happy as how things have turned out, but Israel is probably not thinking that maybe God had something to do with this, as maybe some of us are thinking. But in the midst of chaos, in the midst of uncertainty, people tend to be open to the gospel. And we ought to recognize that and take advantage of that and try to be as effective as we can in our witness to others. And I'm going to talk specifically about sharing the gospel with Jewish people. And I know Oklahoma doesn't have a lot of Jewish people like South Florida does, but there's Jewish people. I guarantee you there's Jewish people in Tulsa, quite a few. And the person, and I'll share this at Sunday school, the first person who I ever heard a very clear gospel message from was from the panhandle of Texas, from Canyon, Texas. And so he had very little contact with Jewish people, but prayed as God moved him to New York City that God would bring a Jewish person in his life that he could impact. And believe me, he impacted my life. So you never know how God's going to answer those kinds of prayers. So tomorrow, during the morning hour, we're going to look at how we can effectively share the gospel to Jewish people and others. And then tomorrow night, we're going to look at some Bible prophecy, dealing particularly with a prophecy at the end of Ezekiel, in Ezekiel 38 and 39, that seems to be talking about a war that may be happening soon, that involves countries that are very, very active right now in current events, countries like Russia and Iran and Turkey. And so we'll look at that tomorrow night. And then on Sunday, we're going to be looking at what I think is the clearest presentation of the gospel in the Old Testament, the prophet Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 53, and looking at that in detail. So that's kind of what we're going to be sharing over the course of the weekend. And hopefully, whatever questions you might have, I'll be able to answer. So could you go to the next slide, please? And so let's talk about in the beginning, because to understand where we are today, we really have to go back to the beginning. Now, I have the joy of saying that all three of my kids have been married off. That's a great feeling, being an empty nester, I have to tell you. And the fact that they're married, they all have children, everybody's walking with the Lord, that's an incredible blessing. And, you know, I've had the privilege of officiating at many weddings, and I've been to, none of my kids wanted me to marry them. That's very interesting, isn't it? But they all wanted me to just be a participant. But at almost every wedding, the very first time you'll hear this verse is at a wedding, and that is from Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. So if you want to open up your Bibles, we're going to spend a lot of time in Genesis this evening. And this is Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. And it's a verse that you're, I'm sure, very familiar with. As I said, you've heard it at weddings. And it says, "For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined or cleave to his wife, and they, the two, shall become one flesh." Familiar with that verse? It's a great verse. It's a wonderful verse to speak about the intimacy that we have in marriage. Not just physical intimacy, but emotional intimacy, spiritual intimacy. It's a great verse, and that's very often shared at weddings. But you never hear the next verse shared at a wedding. I wonder why. It says, "And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed." Why wouldn't they share that at a wedding? Why would anybody want to have the fact that the man and his wife were both naked and not ashamed? What is so important about that? Well, I think what it tells us is in the way that Adam and Eve were created. They were created to have a perfect relationship with God. And they were willing to let God see everything and not be ashamed. There was no guilt. Sin hadn't entered the world yet. And so Adam and Eve had that perfect relationship with God. And ultimately, the fall came, sin was introduced into the world, they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and everything changed. And really, the Bible's main message is to get us back to where we were originally created to be. And we're not there yet. I don't know about you, but I would rather God not sit next to me when I drive my car. Chuck Swindoll once said that the last part of our body to be sanctified is our right foot. And so, you know, I don't know what your thing is, but, you know, when I'm behind the wheel of a car, my personality seems to have a major downward adjustment, if you know what I mean. I'm not the greatest person to behind the wheel. And so I don't put Christian bumper stickers on my car. You know, we all have our little things. But the reality is we don't have that relationship with God that Adam and Eve did, because the fall came, sin entered the world, and God, in Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, go to the next slide, pronounced the demise of Satan, who had brought sin into the world with the whole idea of messing up God's creation, of keeping God's plan from coming to fruition, as though God didn't know what he was up to. And so in Genesis chapter 3, as God is kind of laying out the consequences of the fall, and he says, beginning in verse 14, it says, "The Lord God said to the serpent," and this, we know the serpent from Revelation is Satan, the devil. He says, "Because you have done this, cursed are you more than all cattle and more than every beast of the field. On your belly you will go, and dust you will eat all the days of your life." So you get the sense that maybe the serpent in Genesis 3 wasn't the snake that's usually portrayed, but probably some creature that had legs, because the legs were taken away as part of his punishment. And then in verse 15, God lays out his plan to redeem the world back to where it was supposed to be. "I will put enmity," it means hostility, warfare, "between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head," a fatal blow, "and you shall bruise him on the heel," kind of a non-fatal blow. So what is God doing? He's laying out his plan for the redemption of mankind that ultimately will come through what is called here the seed of the woman. And so the seed of the woman is an unusual statement, because if you've taken high school biology, you know that seed is always associated with the male. So the fact that the seed of the woman is mentioned here is an allusion to the virgin birth. And so it's talking about the Messiah. In fact, this is considered by Bible scholars to be the very first messianic prophecy in the Bible. This is the first time there is any allusion to Jesus mentioned in Genesis 3:15. And so this is laid out as part of the consequences of the fall, and this is how God is going to bring the world back into creation. Go to the next slide. So we see that next. So, the line. That's where Israel comes in. And so I want to talk about this line of the promise through whom the seed will come. And so, turn now to Genesis chapter 4. And this is the birth of the first son of Adam and Eve. Listen to this. It says, "Now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, 'I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord.'" Now, if you have your Bibles, you'll notice that "with the help of the Lord" is italicized. The actual original Hebrew says, "I've given birth to a man-child, the Lord." And so Eve thought that when she got pregnant and gave birth to Cain, that he would be the one who ultimately would be the fulfillment of the prophecy in Genesis 3. But we know, because of Cain and Abel, that that wasn't the case. The line then went not through Cain or Abel, go to the next slide, but it went through their son Seth. And then we have a whole lot of interesting people following Seth, and it takes us all the way up to Noah. And then the story of Noah and the ark, I'm not going to get into it because we don't have the time, but Noah has three sons. Actually, there were eight people left to repopulate the earth. Noah, his three sons, and their wives. That was it. Everybody else died in the flood. So they were left to repopulate the earth, and it would be through Noah's son Shem that the line would continue. And Shem, as Noah's son, that's where we get the term Semite from. It's a descendant of Shem. So when you hear the term Semite or anti-Semite, It's talking about Noah's son Shem. These are descendants of Shem. But the line takes us all the way through Shem's descendants until we come to a man named Abram. And then everything changes. The line is no longer going through individuals. Now, let me give you a little background on Abram. Abram, when he hears from God, is 75 years old. His wife, Sarai, is 65 years old, and they are childless. Now, with all the medical technology today that we have, the oldest woman on record to have a baby, even up till today, is 63 years old. And she actually gave birth to her daughter's baby. She was a carrier. The embryo was implanted in her womb, and she was able to carry the baby and give birth to it. 63 years old. 4,000 years ago, a 65-year-old woman wasn't about to have a baby. So they were long beyond childbearing years. And so with that in mind, I want you to turn to Genesis chapter 12. And we're going to look at what's known as the Abrahamic covenant. Now, they were located in Ur of the Chaldeans. Ur of the Chaldeans is associated with Babylon. If you're following geography today, Babylon is located right in the middle of Iraq. In fact, Saddam Hussein, before he was captured and killed, was feverishly trying to rebuild Babylon because he thought that's where he was going to rule the world as the modern-day Nebuchadnezzar. That's what he thought. And so this is where all this takes place, in Ur of the Chaldeans. I'll share a little story with you. In Jewish tradition, Abraham's father, whose name was Terah, was thought to be an idol seller. He had a shop that sold idols. And the Talmudic story is told that one day he was going into town to take care of some business, and he left his son Abram in charge of the idol shop. And so Abram was totally against the idols, and after his father left, he decided he would destroy all the idols in his shop, except for one. So with a hammer, he feverishly broke up all the idols, and when he was finally finished, he put the hammer in the hand of the only one that he didn't break. And so his father comes back from his being in town, and he looks at his idol shop, and it's completely devastated and destroyed, and he said, "Who did such a thing?" And his son Abram pointed to the idol in the corner that was still intact with the hammer in his hand. And he said, "He did it." And his father said, "Don't be silly, that's just a piece of wood. He couldn't do that." And Abram said to him, "Then why do you worship him?" And so that story is told to kind of be a backdrop for God's calling of Abram. It's when I became a believer and started reading the Bible in earnest, I desperately tried to find that story because it's such a great story, but it's not in the Bible. It's basically Jewish Talmudic tradition. Whether it's true or not, we'll have to wait till we're in heaven with Abram, but it's a good story. So here's the backdrop, and we read this. Genesis chapter 12, beginning with verse 1. "Now the Lord said to Abram, 'Go forth from your country, from your relatives, and from your father's house to the land which I will show you.'" So this is a call to leave Ur of the Chaldeans to go to what would be the promised land. And you can go to Israel, in the northern part of Israel, in a place called Tel Dan, and you could actually go to the gate that Abram entered the promised land. It's an amazing spot. One of my favorites. And listen to what God says to Abram. He says, "And I," God speaking, "will make you a great nation." So God is promising this 75-year-old man and a 65-year-old woman who have no children that God is going to make them a great nation. It's not just going to happen. This nation that ultimately will be called the Hebrews. You know, we talk about the Jews, that comes much later with Jacob's son Judah and the tribe of Judah and the land of Judah when the tribes are split. The proper name for the descendants of Abraham are the Hebrews. And that name literally means the ones who have crossed over. And the place that the Hebrews crossed over was the Euphrates River. As they left Babylon, they crossed the Euphrates River to go to the Promised Land and ultimately would head into what now is Israel. But the nation itself will be supernaturally created by God. There can be no question that this nation didn't just come into being. It was created by God with the express purpose of fulfilling God's promise made all the way back in Genesis 3. That through this created nation by God, God would be able to redeem mankind and bring us back to where we were ultimately intended to be. He says, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. And then verse 3. And I will bless those who bless you. And the one who curses you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So the Abrahamic covenant, a promise of making Abram's name great, and ultimately he becomes Abraham, was given to a 75-year-old man, a 65-year-old woman, with the express purpose of letting them understand that God was going to bless them, and anybody who would curse them would be going against God's will, and God would curse them himself. And so that's the Abrahamic covenant, and I believe we can look today and see that we as a nation have been blessed for this reason, for Genesis 12:3. I will bless those who bless you, and the one who curses you, I will curse. The phrase, in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed, I believe has a dual meaning. First and foremost, it's obviously talking about Jesus. But do you know that in this world, and there are about 3 billion or so people, there are 15 million Jewish people. That's, trying to do the math here. It's about 0.5% of the world's population. 0.5%. That 0.5% has accounted for more than 25% of all the Nobel Prizes, has accounted for some of the most amazing inventions in science and the discoveries of things like polio vaccine. You name the different aspects of the world, and the Jewish people have had an impact. And we can really say a disproportional impact in that this is, in essence, part of this Genesis 12:3 promise. In you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. And so, as this promise is given to Abram of making a great nation, try to imagine the conversation that Abram had with his wife that night. He says to his wife, Sarai, I had a conversation with the Lord. Really? What did the Lord say? Well, he promised to make me a great nation. Really? How's he going to do that? I don't know. But he promised. And so the two of them probably kind of looked at one another, wondering how on earth God was going to do that. And they went about trying to do what God told them to do, to leave Ur of the Chaldeans. And so they left. And they headed to what would be the promised land, to Canaan. And 10 years go by. So at 75 and 65, the likelihood of them having children was already minuscule at best. Now at 85 and 75, what's the likelihood of them having children? Zero. And so turn to Genesis 15. And we could kind of Here, Abram's doubting. Bunch of things happen. He comes face to face with Melchizedek. We won't get into who I think Melchizedek was, but I don't believe it was Jesus, just a type. And it says, after these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision, saying, do not fear, Abram. Now, that phrase, do not fear, fear not, don't be afraid, is used in the Bible. Someone actually calculated this 365 times. 365 times, don't be afraid. And the implication is when God says don't be afraid, God knows that you're afraid. So what is he afraid of? And I think that sometimes we gloss over spiritual warfare. And I think what we're going to look at now, Abram is undergoing some severe, severe spiritual warfare. And he finds himself in a very dark place. He says, do not fear, Abram, I'm a shield to you, a protector. Your reward shall be very great. And now we see Abram's doubt. Abram said, oh, Lord God, what will you give me since I am childless? And the heir of my house is Eliezer of Damascus. So in other words, you made a promise. If I die tomorrow, all of my wealth is going to go to a servant. Not even a family member. He says, since you have given me no offspring, one born in my house is my heir. Then behold, the word of the Lord came to him, saying, and listen carefully to what God says to him. This man will not be your heir, but one who will come forth from your own body, he shall be your heir. Now, if I was God, and you should be glad that I'm not, I may have said it differently considering what's happened because of the way God said this. I may have said, listen, Abe, you know, I know you don't quite understand all of this, but you and your wife are going to have a baby. And that baby is going to be the promised one who is going to be the fulfillment of all these blessings. But God doesn't say that. One from your own body will be your heir. Why doesn't God say that? Because he didn't have to. See, for this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they, the two, shall become one flesh. God's plan for marriage has always been one man, one woman. Not multiple wives, not same sex, one man, one woman. That's God's plan. That's what the Bible says. And so God didn't have to say anything to Abram because it was already understood. But Sarah kind of thought, well, maybe we can work around this. And so turn to chapter 16. Well, let's look at some of the notes because I'm going to go through these pretty quickly. So we see Abraham's plea for an heir. We see the promise of an heir from his body. And God takes him, notice this in verse 15. It says, he took him outside and he now looked toward the heaven and count the stars if you're able to count them. He said to him, so shall your descendants be. Then he, Abram, believed in the Lord and he reckoned it to him as righteousness. A very, very wonderful passage that speaks about faith that sometimes doesn't understand everything, but nevertheless believes because it's God who he's believing. And so Abram is wondering how on earth God's going to prove this. And we read verse 7. I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess it. And Abram says, oh, Lord, how may I know that I will possess it? And so there is a covenant that's about to be affirmed. And the covenant is affirmed through the killing of animals. He said to him, He says, bring me a three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old female goat, a three-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. He brought all of these to him, cut them in two, laid half opposite the other, but he did not cut the birds. So try to imagine a pathway strewn with dead animals. And basically, the way the covenant would be confirmed is the parties of the covenant would walk in between the pieces of the animal and basically make an oath that if I don't keep my covenant with you, both of the parties, then this should happen to me. What happened to these animals? That's the way the oath is made. And so that is being laid out. Then it says in verse 11, the birds of prey came down upon the carcasses. He drove them away. Now verse 12, and I want you to listen carefully to this. When the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram. Behold, terror and great darkness fell upon him. Once again, I believe what we're seeing is spiritual warfare. And the reason it's so intense is this is a moment in time that is going to impact eternity. And Satan knows it and is trying to do everything in his power to keep it from happening. And God said to Abram, know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. But I will judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions. Talking about the time in Egypt and the Exodus. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You will be buried at a good old age. So you can see what the spiritual warfare is, the kind of things that were being whispered in his ear. You're not going to live a long life. Your descendants are going to be slaves. And God's explaining to him all that's going to happen. Then verse 17. It came about when the sun had set that it was very dark. Behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a flaming torch which passed between these pieces. And I want you to notice back in verse 12 that Abram was asleep. So as all of this is going on, this flaming torch and smoking oven appear. And they pass between the pieces. So as this flaming torch and smoking oven passed between the pieces, what was happening is God was affirming the covenant with Abraham, but he was doing it unilaterally. Abram was asleep. The Abrahamic covenant that is so critical to understanding Israel theologically was a unilateral covenant. It was made and affirmed by God himself. Abram was not a party to it. He didn't have to do anything for it to take place. Only God. And so that's so important in understanding what takes place in the future. So this covenant unilaterally also included the land. Because we read in verse 18, on that day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land. Everybody hear that? To your descendants I have given this land. From the river of Egypt, where's that? It's the Nile River. So try to imagine the Nile River on the west going east as far as the great river, the river Euphrates. So from the Nile River all the way east to what is now Iraq, and then the clans that are mentioned, the Kenite, the Kenizzite, the Kadmonite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Rephaim, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Girgashite, and the Jebusite really incorporate much of the what we call the Arabian Peninsula. So the promised land that God gave to Abram is a lot more than that little piece of land that's about the size of the state of New Jersey today that we call Israel. It's much bigger. So you can go home tonight and say, this big Jewish guy said Israel ought to declare that the land in the Middle East all belongs to them because God gave it to them. And eventually he will, but that's not what I'm saying. I just want you to understand what the promise given to Israel was. And it was for land. That's an important part of all of this, is that God promised the land. And so they're still childless after this takes place. And so Sarah comes up with a really, really good idea, so she thought. Since she's now 75 years old, there's no chance whatsoever that she can have a baby. But maybe old Abe could, in his old age, do something about that. And so she has a slave, an Egyptian named Hagar, who was young, within childbearing years, perhaps attractive, and she is going to bring her into the house to be a baby breeder. But here's the kicker. She was bringing her into the house as his wife. And so this was not a one-night stand. This was a new lifestyle. And so now Abram, who will eventually be called Abraham, has two wives. And in his tent, when he went to bed at night, he went to bed with the baby breeder, not with Sarai. And Hagar got pregnant. And through natural means, she got pregnant and eventually gave birth to a son. And Abram was thrilled. This would be the son that God promised. Hagar was merely the surrogate. It would still be his and Sarah's son. Mm-mm. Hagar made very plain to Sarah that now that she was pregnant, he loved her more. And she tormented Sarah for the fact that I could give him children and you can't. And so Sarah drives her away. And she meets someone who's called the angel of the Lord. And the vast majority of Bible scholars believe the angel of the Lord is none other than a pre-incarnate appearance of Jesus himself. So Jesus himself tells her to go back to her mistress and have the baby, which she does. And so the baby is born, Abram is celebrating, and everything is hunky-dory. So they think. And now, at the age of 13, Abram's now 99 years old, Ishmael is 13, all of the household, everybody born in his house is now circumcised as a sign of the covenant. And so, in Genesis chapter 17, verse 25, and Ishmael his son was 13 years old when he was circumcised in the flesh of his foreskin. So, just a bit of trivia. Ishmael, who was considered by most Arab nations to be the father of the Arab nations, is actually a circumcised Hebrew. In Genesis 17. And so at the age of 13, this is the sign of the covenant that God made with Abraham, and everything is done. Except God shows up and says, "That wasn't what I meant." And God says, "You and Sarah are going to have a baby." And Sarah overhears God speaking to Abraham. He says, "Go find Sarah, your wife. I want to let her know that she's going to have a baby." And what does Sarah do? She laughs. She was 89 years old. Her husband was 99 years old. And God said, "You're going to have a baby." And they laughed. And in the course of time, she got pregnant and gave birth to a son. And God told them to name the baby in Hebrew Yitzchak, which means laughter. And so that's where Isaac's name comes from. So Isaac is born, and there is now this reason for what's going on in the Middle East today. It's a family feud. That, in a nutshell, is what's going on in the Middle East. we have a promise of great blessing, a promise of a great nation, and who is going to be the one to bring that great nation? Is it going to be Ishmael, or is it going to be Isaac? That's the question. So, let's look at chapter 22. Isaac is now grown up. Abraham is so enamored by the fact that he has this son from his wife Sarah that it's almost idolatrous the way he loves him. And so we read in chapter 22, it came about after these things that God tested Abraham. And he said to him, Abraham, Abraham, and he said, here I am. God said to him, listen to this, these words. Take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. And so, basically what God said to Abraham is, I want you to take this son of yours, and he calls him his only son, and I want you to go to this place far away, a place called Moriah, and when you get there, I want you to take him, build an altar, cut his throat till he dies, and then burn him till there's nothing left. You get that, Abe? That was what God said to him. And we don't see anything in the passage that tells us that he ruminated over this. He just obeyed God. Next verse, Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son. He split wood for the burnt offering, arose, and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there, and we will worship, and we will return to you. So, as they traveled to Moriah, they went up to this place, and he told his servants to wait. We're going to go there, and what I'm going to do is an act of worship, and then when I'm finished, we both are coming back to you. And the book of Hebrews said that Abraham believed that God could raise even the dead, even though there was no precedence for it at this point, because he believed the promise of God. And he believed that that's what God would do. And so, as we look at this passage, I want you to notice a few things. Let's read on. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on Isaac his son. He took in his hand the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, my father. And he said, here I am, my son. And Isaac said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him. Abraham built the altar there, arranged the wood, bound his son Isaac, and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. Notice this, but the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham, he said, here I am. He said, don't stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And so we have clearly this angel of the Lord spoken of as God here. Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. Abraham went and took the ram, offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And he called the name of the place Jehovah Jireh, the Lord will provide. As it is said to this day, in the mount of the Lord, it will be provided. And so, we see the sacrifice of Isaac. Go to the next slide. Here's something very interesting. Now, I'm going to share with you just briefly Moriah. there are the vast majority of Bible scholars who will tell you the temple was built on Mount Moriah. And so most of those Bible scholars, not all of them, but most of them will say that the place where Abraham ultimately went to sacrifice Isaac was on the Temple Mount where the temple was. Now, the Temple Mount today only has two things on top of it, neither of which is the Jewish temple. In fact, if you follow the news, the UNESCO actually just said there's no precedence for the Jews ever being on the Temple Mount. But on the Temple Mount is the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, two Muslim holy sites. And so the Muslim interpretation of this, the Islamic interpretation, is that Mount Moriah, the Dome of the Rock, is a place that is very important as a Muslim holy site. Two things they believe happen on there. Number one, first and foremost, from that place is where Muhammad ascended into heaven, riding on his flying horse called Barak, believe it or not, and he ascended into heaven. That's number one. Number two is that rock is the place where Abraham brought Ishmael to be sacrificed. Ishmael. That's the Islamic interpretation, that it was Ishmael that Abraham was going to sacrifice, not Isaac. It's Ishmael that was his only son, the one whom he loved. And so there is the difference. And it is not only a political difference, it is a religious difference. You have the Bible, you have the Quran, and they say two different things. So you cannot take religion out of this exercise. You cannot say this is merely a political problem that needs to be politically solved. It's not. There is no political solution for this problem. This is a problem of a spiritual nature that only God could solve. And so, as you see, go to the next couple of slides. The covenant would ultimately be reiterated with Isaac and then ultimately with Jacob. But here's what I want to show you, and I think God made this very plain. Next slide. Isaac clearly is seen in the scriptures as a type of Christ. And Genesis 22 is so remarkable in the parallels that I think it's worth looking at in a little depth. And if you look at Hebrews chapter 11, the Hall of Faith passage, I just want to look at it for a moment. Hebrews chapter 11. Verse 17, it says, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. It was he to whom it was said, in Isaac your descendants shall be called. He considered, listen to this, that God is able to raise people even from the dead, from which he also received him back as a type. So Isaac is very clearly shown to be a type of Christ. And I want to show you all the different aspects of it. And obviously the first one is pretty clear cut. The miraculous birth. We have Jesus born of a virgin, probably about a 15 or 16 year old virgin. Isaac, on the other hand, is born to a 90 year old woman. Would you say that that's miraculous? Of course. So we have both of them, miraculous birth. Secondly, Isaac is called your only son. Take now your son, your only son. And I think clearly we can make a connection to John 3:16. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. And the reason Isaac is called your only son is because he was the son of the promise. He was the son of the miracle. Ishmael was born of natural means, born of the flesh. And so here's an interesting one. Go back to Genesis 22. When you come to Genesis 23, which happens right after this incident, it talks about the death of Sarah. And it says, Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. So she was 127 years old when she died. How old would that have made Isaac? Would have made him 37 when Genesis 23 begins. And so, here's what I believe. I believe when Abraham was told to sacrifice Isaac, Isaac was the same age that Jesus was when he was sacrificed. Same age. It was all part of God's plan to show Isaac as a type of Christ. Now, the Bible doesn't say that specifically, but I believe as we look at this all in its context, you can make a really good educated guess at this. Go to the next one. Again, as we look at Isaac as a type, what does it say Abraham believed? He believed that he was going to go and kill his son. That's what God told him to do. He had no idea that God was going to stop him. And because he believed that he was going to kill his son and that he was the one who through whom all the promises would come, then he believed that God would raise him from the dead. On the third day, it says, he saw Moriah at a distance. And so, we have the resurrection. Now, as they were going up the mountain, what was Isaac doing? He was carrying the wood up to Mount Moriah, the place of his death. As Jesus went to Golgotha, and we're going to talk about that in a moment, what was he doing? He was carrying the wood, the crossbeam that he would carry to be crucified. And ultimately, because of the beating that he took, he needed help carrying it. Now, remember I said Mount Moriah is the Temple Mount? If you look at Mount Moriah and take it out to the northern part of the old city, actually outside of the old city, you'll come to a place that now is an Arab bus depot in East Jerusalem. Did you go there? Okay. Now, there are two main places that are thought to be the place where Jesus was crucified. Number one is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. It's a Catholic site. It would have been outside of the city in the day of Jesus, so it does sort of fit that. But there's nothing around it that would indicate anything other than the Catholic Church says this is the place. But when you go to this other place, you come to a place where there's a cliff, and on the face of the cliff you can make out, not as clearly as 100 years ago when they have pictures going back 100 years, you can make out the face of a skull. It's called the Garden Tomb Ministry. It's actually a British ministry, and it's sort of the Protestant site believed to be where the crucifixion took place. That would still be part of Mount Moriah. So let me throw this one out to you. Rather than Abraham taking him up to where the temple ultimately would be, I believe Abraham took him to where Jesus ultimately would be sacrificed. Right on Mount Moriah. And then lastly, well, he was laid on the wood to be sacrificed. Both Jesus and Isaac were laid on this altar, on the wood, to be sacrificed. Lastly, we don't see Isaac again after Genesis 22 until we see him with his bride. And so, we're not going to see Jesus again until he's with his bride. The parallels are amazing. And so, we're going to take a break here. Just for a moment. And There's a part two to this. But we've been going for about an hour, so I'm going to give you 5 minutes to kind of clear your thoughts, maybe take a bathroom break, whatever you might need to do, and then we're going to come back in 5 minutes. How's that? And finish this up.